This is OBG Project's Grand Rounds Live, a podcast of the OBG Project's monthly webinar featuring cutting-edge OB and GYN topics. Our Grand Rounds Live webinar is free for OBG First members. With an OBG First membership, you have access to the webinar slides, handouts, and future Grand Rounds Live webinars. To learn more about membership and other perks of an OBG First membership, go to obgproject.com/get first. Enjoy the webinar.
Welcome to OBG Grand Rounds, and I am thrilled to introduce our second in the series. Tonight we have a great talk. I'm Rebecca Dunsmore-Sue. I'm a generalist gynecologist in Seattle. And I work with OBG Project on their L&D book, I'm also a previous OB hospitalist, so this is an interest area of mine in terms of trial of labor and VBAC. Before we get started, I do want to announce next Grand Rounds, which will be June 22nd at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. And that is going to be with Dr. Carrie Sapato, and she's going to speak to us about vulvovaginal disorders, which I know is a big area that people really want to hear about. She is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology and the medical director of primary care GYN clinics for Northridge University Physicians for Women at the University of Virginia. So that will be a great talk as well. But tonight, we are lucky, very lucky to have Sarah Petruska to talk with us. She is a general obstetrician gynecologist, an associate professor, and clerkship director and medical director for labor and delivery at the University of Louisville in Louisville, Kentucky. She got her BS from Boston College and went to the University of Florida College of Medicine and completed residency training and a medical education fellowship at State University of New York at Stony Brook. After 4 years faculty there, she relocated to Louisville in 2008, and her practice interests are medical education, patient-centered obstetrics, and faculty development for women in medicine and science. So, Sarah, I am thrilled to invite you for this talk. I'm excited to hear about vaginal birth after cesarean section and trial of labor. So take it away. I think you are still mute.
Yeah, in the second year of the pandemic, I'll get the handle on the mute button there. All right, good evening, everybody. I'm glad to talk about VBAC tonight. I, as was mentioned, I'm at the University of Louisville, which is a level one trauma center and an academic medical center. We have fantastic critical care support and a great blood bank. So if you're going to have a TOLAC, it's a pretty good place for it. We have 24-hour in-house coverage on labor and delivery, so I realize that's not the setting for everybody, but that's where I'm speaking from. So I've been here for about 13 years. We take care of a very diverse population of patients from all over the world, and I've done a lot of reflecting on VBAC as a topic where I think it gives us an opportunity to really impact some important maternal health indicators like the cesarean section rate. But I think it's also a great lens into some other really important issues in women's health, like autonomy and equity and support for postpartum patients, and even just the language we use when we're counseling patients every day on a number of different issues. So we hope to hit those important points today. There we go. I have no disclosures relevant to the talk today. In terms of objectives, so after today, you should be able to assess factors that impact the risks and benefits of a trial of labor. You should be able to describe the role of maternal autonomy in the decision for a C-section and assess a patient's chances for a successful trial of labor. And importantly, help her identify factors that she might want to weigh in deciding what value a successful VBAC holds for her. So for starters, so just weighing the risks and benefits of TOLAC. So we weigh risks and benefits all the time. I think we focused first on uterine rupture as the risk, and that makes me want to tell you the first of three uterine rupture stories that I have for you today. The first one is the funniest rupture that I've ever seen. So I came on service one morning and we had a TOLAC patient who was laboring, and I would say it's one of those labors where she was failing to tolerate adequate contractions. So if the pit was on, she was making change, but she was having deep variables. And if the pit was off, the tracing looked okay, but she wasn't making any progress. So I went in and met her and counseled her that I thought she'd given it a good try. And I thought it was time to go to the operating room, that we were seeing these variables, and that actually when you look retrospectively from a uterine rupture, The most common fetal heart rate abnormality that you see is variable decelerations. So she agreed. We shut off the pit and we went to the operating room with a category one fetal heart tracing. So we get into the peritoneal cavity and we see a gigantic window with the baby's hair visible through it. And my resident had never seen this before. So she says, "Why does the bladder look so funny?" And just as I'm saying, "That's not the bladder," this baby takes his fist and punches it out through the what remained of the lower uterine segment, made the hysterotomy for himself. And in that moment, I thought three things. First of all, I thought, okay, this is now a uterine rupture. Number two, this baby is fine. And number three, if I saw this in a movie, I would say this is ridiculous. It would never happen like that in real life. But it did. It does. So let's start by talking about the risks of trial of labor. So thinking about the maternal considerations first. So it's important to compare a trial of labor after cesarean with its alternative, which is an elective repeat cesarean delivery. In this form, which this table, which comes from the ACOG practice bulletin, which was most recently updated in 2019, we see the comparison of those two options. So red highlights where there is a significant difference between these two options. So more endometritis following TOLAC than scheduled repeat C-section, more uterine ruptures in the TOLAC group, but these were also present in the C-section group. For the other factors listed, if there was a difference, it was higher in the cesarean delivery group. So more operative injuries, more maternal deaths, more subsequent previas and accretas, longer hospital stay, more narcotics, and a longer postpartum recovery. And of course, we have two patients. So the risk to the fetus. So here, most of the adverse outcomes listed were higher in the TOLAC group. So more HIE, more neonatal and perinatal death. And if you add those two together, you actually see more than a threefold increase in death between the perinatal and neonatal components with TOLAC in comparison to repeat cesarean delivery. More NICU admissions for the TOLAC group. And then on the cesarean delivery side, the increased risk for needing respiratory support that we generally see with cesarean deliveries. Drilling down a little bit more into the specific risk for uterine rupture, which is often the big thing in our minds, a general background rate of anywhere from 0.5% to about 1%, depending on which study you look at. So a higher risk with prior classical or myomectomy, the rate there varies between studies, but most commonly quoted is 5 to 7%. A patient with more than one prior C-section, again, the rates are variable by about 1.5 to 2% or so. A shorter interdelivery interval, induction of labor. So with one prior section, this was described in one study as increasing the risk from 0.9% for spontaneous labor to 1.8% with induction of labor. Patients who had no prior vaginal delivery, who ended up having a birth weight over 4 kilos, but of course we don't get to know that ahead of time. Patients who had an infection at the time of their prior cesarean delivery, and patients who had a thin lower uterine segment on ultrasound, although we don't know of a safe or unsafe threshold for ultrasound evaluation of the lower uterine segment. Patients who may have a lower risk for uterine rupture, a two-layer closure of the prior hysterotomy, an interdelivery interval, some studies look at 18 months, some look at 19 months, patients who labor spontaneously, patients in preterm labor, and patients who did have a prior vaginal delivery. So the second rupture story, this is what I always have in mind when I counsel a TOLAC patient, and it's the most recent rupture that I've seen, whenever that was. So on some lay media sites, there's sometimes the impression that rupture isn't real, that it's an ominous fairy tale that we tell patients to coerce them into a repeat C-section. And I tell patients that I counsel, it's real. I've been there when it happens. I had one last week, last month, last winter, whenever it was. So at this point in time, right now, my most recent rupture was last month. The mother and the baby did okay. It was a patient who had had a prior successful vaginal birth after C-section, but this baby was bigger than the ones that she had had before. And mom and the baby did well in this situation. So when I'm counseling patients, I talk about increased risk for hemorrhage, for hysterectomy, if rupture occurs, and an increased chance for neurologic damage to the baby. And I try to make that objective. So to say something like a child who may never learn to walk or to speak, who may be in a wheelchair, unable to communicate, who may need 24-hour care. So I think we have the responsibility both to communicate that statistically it's a small chance, but that it's a small chance of some big deal stuff. So those are the maternal and fetal risks of TOLAC versus section. So how about benefits? In terms of the benefits of a repeat cesarean delivery, it avoids the risks that are higher in TOLAC, which we just talked about. It's a little bit more predictable logistically. So if a family is facing a deployment or other logistical considerations, that may be helpful. It offers surgical access if the patient is thinking about a tubal. And then let's think about the benefits of trial of labor after cesarean. So the benefit really largely rests not in the trial of labor, but with a successful VBAC itself. So avoiding major abdominal surgery, its attendant risks such as operative injury, higher indicators of lactation success among vaginal delivery patients than C-section, avoiding narcotics, a shorter hospital stay, shorter recovery. I should have advanced my slide. We know that patients who choose TOLAC but who end up needing a cesarean delivery have a higher chance of many adverse outcomes, including infections, hemorrhage, uterine rupture. So it can be helpful to our patient if we give her an idea of her chance for successful VBAC, her chance for realizing the benefits of the trial of labor. So increased chance for success. A younger age, lower BMI, a prior vaginal delivery, especially if it was since the cesarean, less than 40 weeks estimated gestational age, a smaller birth weight, a non-recurring indication for the first C-section, such as having it done for breech. And then factors that the data show are associated with a lower chance for success would be higher maternal age, higher BMI, no prior vaginal delivery, undergoing induction or augmentation of labor, gestational age greater than 40 weeks, a higher birth weight, prior C-section performed for an arrest of dilation or arrest of descent, non-white race or ethnicity, and I have a lot to say about that in a bit, and obesity. Gestational diabetes. So some of these factors, like obesity and labor induction, are kind of two hits where they both increase the risk for rupture and decrease the chance for success. And I think it's also important, like the patient I just mentioned, to remember that even a really high chance for success doesn't mean that uterine rupture won't happen. So a tool which takes some of these factors into success is the Maternal Fetal Medicine Unit VBAC calculator, which is available online. So the fields that we're used to entering are age, height and weight, or BMI, African American or not, Hispanic or not, any prior vaginal delivery, any delivery since the cesarean, and then whether the cesarean was for arrest of labor or not. The data that went into the development of that calculator came from about 15,000 trials of labor, which occurred from 1999 to 2002, so quite some time ago. And these were all patients with one prior low segment transverse cesarean delivery undergoing TOLAC at term with a singleton fetus in a cephalic presentation. So ACOG suggests that if the calculator gives us a chance for success that's under 60%, a scheduled repeat cesarean delivery is probably the less morbid route of delivery for the patient. And this is where we really have to throw in several grains of salt. So for starters, labor management has changed a lot since the deliveries in the data that generated the calculator. In terms of statistical performance, there's been validation at several different institutions showing that the calculator's predictions are less accurate, especially for patients whose predicted success rate is between 30 and 60%, which is kind of honestly frequently the target of our interest. A very, very big deal, which is rightfully receiving increasing attention over the past couple of years, is the role of race and ethnicity in the calculator. So for two patients who are otherwise identical, entering that the patient was African American would drastically drop the chance for success. In my own experience, I felt like I saw the effect of age and BMI on the patient's TOLAC success, but I didn't feel that way in my own practice about race. And several years ago, I looked at our institution's data. I saw that our Black patients actually had a little bit higher chance for success in a VBAC than our Caucasian patients. So I started giving my African American patients both numbers and telling them that I didn't think the lower number applied at our institution. That finding has been replicated at many sites now. So when I look back on papers on this topic in the late 2000s, so sort of after the deliveries that went into the calculator, but at the during the development of the calculator, I see a very biological perspective. So for example, a paper from 2006, which speculates that maybe the difference that they saw was due to differences in collagen, so collagen variability in the cervix. I think that the literature has been very late to the game in realizing or thinking about race as a social construct and not biology. And that when we see a racial disparity in outcomes, we should really look for ways that systems of care and structural racism have adversely affected a population rather than looking for biological explanations. You know, when we're talking about something like the indication for cesarean delivery, that is it's a very complex determination. It's not like an electrophoresis that says the patient has a thalassemia. So it's a very complex thing, which could easily be affected by many, many different forces. So for example, we know that BIPOC people can have a harder time accessing prenatal care. And it makes sense that when someone shows up in labor without having had prenatal care as an unassigned OB patient, she's less likely to have someone in her corner, less likely to have the time or relationship for a full counseling discussion on the route of delivery, and maybe more likely to be receiving care from somebody who might be less likely to offer her the full scope of her options, maybe more likely to just tell her that a repeat C-section is just what we do. So that's the way that is a way that structural racism can manifest. So I think this is the first of what I'm going to call the elephants in the room of our TOLAC counseling. So the calculators they're a good start. I do think they're useful, but they should be approached with caution. And Dr. Shantz Dunn and her colleagues at Harvard published a commentary on women's health issues in 2019. I think they put it really well. So a quote from that is, "Since the observational data reflected a snapshot in time, it's unsurprising that it revealed racial and ethnic disparities that are known to exist. But if we systematize these existing disparities by building race and ethnicity subtraction factors into a predictive tool, we risk ensuring that these trends will simply continue." So I think that makes logical sense. So in many abstracts published in AJOG in February, we're exploring this topic. Faulkner and all found, as I did, that race and ethnicity variables didn't actually decrease VBAC success at their centers. Among their non-Hispanic Black patients, they found who actually had a successful VBAC, they found that 44% would have been told that they were not a good candidate for a trial of labor, as opposed to 12% if race and ethnicity were excluded. And I was actually playing with the calculator last Thursday to try to create some examples of how these numbers work, and an amazing thing happened. In the middle of the day, last Thursday, MFMU took down the old calculator and put up a new one, which does not have the race and ethnicity fields anymore. That page now notes a paper forthcoming in AJOG about the change, but it's not yet available. At least I couldn't, or my librarian could not get her hands on it either. I think that's good progress. It represents good discussion. There's a lot more work that needs to be done around that. So far we've been talking about benefit as the chance for success. So meaning that if the patient doesn't succeed in having a vaginal delivery, then it's hard to justify the risk of a trial of labor. And that brings me to my third rupture story. And this one it's a rupture that did not happen. So we had a patient who was admitted with a plan for induction of labor for worsening chronic hypertension. She had one prior cesarean delivery. She was 42 years old and she had a BMI of 72. For a patient like this, there's just no risk-free way to deliver her. This is a patient for whom there's not really an option for a stat C-section. If there's an emergency, you're just not going to be able to get the baby out very quickly. So on the calculator, according to the calculator, her chance for a successful VBAC was approximately the same as her chance for a uterine rupture. So weighing those risks and benefits, we opted for a planned, calm, orderly repeat cesarean instead, and she and her baby both did well. So that's a rupture that didn't have to happen. So I do like, going back to the benefit as the chance for success, I like the suggestion that ACOG put out that under 60%, we should counsel the patient directly towards a repeat cesarean delivery as probably the less morbid option. And when I started to apply that in practice and use it for counseling patients, the you know, the clarity of that appealed to me. And I couldn't understand sometimes why when I counseled patients, they'd say, well, thank you very much, but I just want to try anyways. So I felt like I was missing something. So I think that the part of it is that the value of that success, the value of an actual VBAC, if it occurs, is not the same to every patient. And it's not something that can come out of a calculator. So it has to come from the patient. So we have the patient's chance for a successful VBAC, but we also have to think of the value of that success. And I think about that kind of as a multiplier on the chance for success in what determines the actual benefit for a patient. So there are some things that might make a VBAC hold more value for a patient. So if she has limited assistance at home for her recovery, if she needs to get back to work quickly, if her kids at home need diapering or lifting, if she plans more future pregnancies, so a VBAC now could avert more than one cesarean delivery, if she has morbid obesity and so she's got increased surgical risks, if she has a prior substance use disorder and she's hoping to avoid narcotics if possible, if she places personal value on having a vaginal delivery. And then a patient who might put less value on a VBAC, someone who has lots of help at home, no pressure to get back to work, older kids at home, maybe kids who are going to help her with the diaper changes for the baby, patients who've completed childbearing, especially if they're thinking about having a tubal. So, you know, if we have on the one hand a school teacher who's starting her summer early with her maternity leave, and she'll be off for the summer and for the fall semester, and her partner gets maternity leave and her mother lives down the street, her other kids are 5 and 7, and she's planning a tubal, she might really just not feel like the risk and uncertainty of a TOLAC is worth it to her at all. On the other hand, a patient who waits tables and has no paid leave, no support from a partner or a family, a kid at home in diapers, she might be one of those patients who says, look, I get it that my chance is only 45%, but if it can happen, that would mean the world to me. So some of those factors are personal, but some of them, in particular the paid leave, bring us to our next elephant in the room, which is the lack of adequate support for postpartum families. You know, the fact that some people might feel like they had to accept a higher risk that their uterus would explode because they need to be able to get back to work in 3 weeks. Some people have the privilege of making this decision based on the medical risks and benefits for them, and other people are making this decision under an awful lot of duress. So that's the chance for success and the value of success. Is there any benefit to trial of labor outside of success, outside of actually succeeding in a VBAC? So I think there's no medical benefit to laboring, but sometimes the patient does perceive a benefit from the chance to labor. And you'll hear the patient say, I just want to have a chance. I just want to have a choice. So that has value to some patients, even if they don't end up with a successful vaginal delivery. And that brings us to our next background issue. So the environment of the patient's first cesarean delivery. So I meet patients sometimes who have, you know, they've obtained their records and they've figured out that maybe actually their first C-section had kind of a sketchy indication. Maybe it wasn't absolutely needed. And that seems to be a motivator for trials of labor sometimes. We meet patients who experience their first cesarean delivery as traumatic. So picture somebody who abrupts in labor. We race back into the OR and 7 minutes from decision to incision, we pull out a baby and APGARs are 8 and 9. We feel like that's such a win. We feel like that's a save. Great obstetrics, like that's why we're here. And we have to remember that it can be absolutely terrifying for the patient and for her family. So the patient may feel like a dehumanized object as we transfer her and prep her and drape her. She may truly fear for her life and for her baby's life. And when we talk about traumatic birth, we usually mean things like there was a fourth degree tear, or there was a brachial plexus injury for the newborn, like some kind of injury. That's what we mean when we say birth trauma. But when patients use the expression, they're talking about their experience. And I think sometimes we fail to hear that. So we don't take it to heart and we just say, you know, healthy mom, healthy baby, all is well. And when the dust settles, she'll realize that. So in actuality, about 3% of all postpartum patients have clinically significant post-traumatic stress disorder. More than one in three patients who underwent emergency cesarean delivery, one in three. So that's real, that's data. This is something that we need to respond to. So we currently lack evidence on what we can do to prevent that. So things that we could do prior to and during the cesarean to decrease the chance that the patient is living it as a traumatic experience. There's some research on postpartum measures, including making sure that there's skin-to-skin contact with the baby, counseling, expressive writing can help. There's some really interesting evidence that visuospatial tasks can influence how memories are consolidated in the first hours after a traumatic experience. So one study where they actually found that visuospatial manipulation tasks in the form of they had patients play Tetris could decrease intrusive thoughts of the trauma in the future in the childbirth setting. So this is real stuff. So in the absence of evidence on primary prevention, some common sense. So for sure, making sure that the cesarean delivery is indicated, making sure that the decision making is shared. There's been some evidence that using the term cesarean delivery rather than cesarean section is actually associated with greater postpartum self-efficacy for the mother. So less of a sense that she is somehow a flawed organism that had to be rescued from her failure. Using this language of choice, I think, is important. And I think it's important caring for diverse populations as well. So, oops. Sorry. There we go. So to stay away from language that implies a power differential. So phrases like let you labor longer or allow more time or permit X or Y. And I think these are principles that are important for all of the care that we give. So in a TOLAC counseling situation, if your practice isn't set up to meet the needs of a TOLAC patient, we should say we aren't set up to support you well in a TOLAC instead of we don't allow that. So I think that language is important. And then speaking of the practice not being set up to be able to support a VBAC well, it brings me to another realm of risk, because this has risk for some physicians too. When we think about why as a country maybe we're doing less VBAC than some people would hope, I think we have to think about the impact on physicians. So for one thing, the medical legal risks. We often say you don't get sued for the C-sections that you do, you get sued for the ones you didn't do. We know that states where there's a higher malpractice premium have lower VBAC rates. We know that physicians who've had a personal experience with a tort related to a VBAC have lower TOLAC rates. So I don't think that's surprising. And it's just easier to do the section than to take on this liability. So that's a reason that practices may just decide it's in their interest to refer these patients on. The counseling is pretty sprawling. So in the best case scenario, if I've got this patient booked as my last patient of the day and I've got all the time in the world to talk with her, we review the medical risks and the benefits. We talk about all the underpinnings of the value of the VBAC to the patient, of the value that she may place on the labor experience. We talk about her first cesarean delivery. We talk about our practice structure and the institutional assets that we have to either support TOLAC or make it harder. A lot of good work is being done now on patient decision aids, so actual frameworks that can structure this discussion. So it's possible to measure how much the patient felt like the decision was one of shared decision making. So a lot of this work is showing that using a patient decision aid doesn't actually change the TOLAC rate, but it decreases what's called decisional conflict. So you can actually assess how at rest the patient is with the decision that she made, how she felt about the process. So is this counseling fast? No, totally no. And is a labor fast in comparison with a repeat C-section? Also no. So this is our last elephant in the room. The global obstetrical fee, I think, is a massive disincentive to this care because we can't bill for our time. So a private practice physician is disincentivized to cancel all the office hours for the day to go be immediately available for a TOLAC. ACOG and SMFM's consensus statement recommends that TOLAC only happen at centers where emergency cesarean is immediately available, so we have to be present to staff that. A labor's model can help, but we don't all have that model. And all of us are disincentivized to spend 30 minutes truly counseling a patient on this decision because we don't get paid for that time either. So I think the global obstetrical fee, under which we cannot realistically be reimbursed for time invested is another factor that leads to low TOLAC rates in many settings. So we started off saying we would weigh the risks and benefits of TOLAC. I think choice in the route of delivery is a right for our patients who've had a prior cesarean delivery. It's assault if we section them without their consent. ACOG says there should essentially never be a situation where we seek to go against the decision of a patient who's competent to make medical decisions, who's been counseled on her options and declined cesarean delivery. So even if we think that option is clearly the most medically preferred route, and if she declines, she should be autonomous in that decision. But these autonomous decisions are being made with the background of all of these elephants in the room. I think the more these are addressed, the more the decision can focus back to the medical risks and benefits for the patient, the patient's body, and her family. And until that time, I think you're not alone if you find TOLAC to be a clinical challenge. So that's the end of my slides that I have. And now we'll move on to the discussion portion of the Grand Rounds Live.
Hello, I'm back. Thank you so much for that. That was really wonderful. And I wanted to start off with a couple of questions to just sort of get us talking about this. And then we'll also field questions from the audience. So if you're out there watching and have specific things you would like to ask Sarah, please send them in via the Q&A and we will absolutely get to them. First, you started by talking about neonatal and maternal risks. Can we tell in the data if some of these risks come from planned out-of-hospital births? Because I know all of us sort of see some out-of-hospital TOLACing going on. Could that be falsely inflating maybe the uterine rupture risk?
I can't specifically speak to uterine rupture. One of the reasons behind the statement that TOLAC should happen where immediate C-section is possible. ACOG says that it's because we don't have enough data about out-of-hospital TOLAC. But there's starting to be a little bit more evidence about that. So Frank Chervenak did a study of birth certificates in the United States, and he saw just looking at, so this is addressing the question of risks in a home TOLAC rather than the effect of planned home VBACs who are brought to the hospital affecting the data of the entire pool. So first of all, I think probably the numbers are, when you look at the birth certificate level data, probably the numbers of transfers in from home for planned home VBACs, probably not a huge player. But in his data set, which looked at birth certificates, so we all know that that has some flaws, he saw a tenfold increase in a composite outcome for adverse neonatal experiences, lower 5-minute APGARs, more seizures. So a lot of things that seem enriched in that pool. In MANA's data, so the Midwifery Alliance of North America, they, in their own data pool, they saw a fourfold increase in neonatal death in comparison to their own data for multips without a prior section delivering at home. So I think there's some increased evidence of harm. In England, so a lot of times when people talk about planned home birth, they like to invoke the stats from Europe. And I think it's really important to remember that that happens in the setting of an entire system, which is a lot more integrated than what we all have here. But in England, they had a pretty high transfer rate. It was about like a third of patients would transfer to the hospital, but they didn't see a difference in maternal or fetal outcomes, neonatal outcomes. So it would make me nervous, but that's interesting data that maybe a better system could help. And then all of this, it's interesting, like there's a real lag, I think, between the data. So like in Manna's paper, which came out in 2015, that was based on a data pool from 2004 to 2009. So a lot of these large scale, big data analyses, which is kind of what you have to do to get significant numbers of uterine ruptures, there's a lag.
That's true. Second question, and you and I have talked about this a little bit before. So Tatiana Ali recently went public with her childbirth story, and she describes being out of control and feeling she got substandard care due to her race. I think many of us who read the story the first time as OBGYNs were sort of initially defensive. We could explain she was having a shoulder dystocia. We knew each of the things that they were doing and why. But then I know I personally had to take a step back and say, it doesn't matter if I can explain what was going on, she couldn't. And she didn't understand what was going on, and it was frightening and out of control. Given what we know about how race has been used to encourage or prevent VBAC attempt, as well as how Black women are especially disregarded and mistreated in medicine, how do you walk through the VBAC counseling with a mother of color to help her both understand her risks and what might happen in labor? Mm-hmm. And are there other interventions you might recommend for her to help her?
Great question. So I read that article too. I think when you use the word defensive, like I have felt that way a lot. And I think we got to take a step back, like you did, when we notice that we're feeling defensive. There's a quote by, it's attributed to Walt Whitman a lot, and I don't think there's any evidence that he actually said it, but to be curious and not judgmental. And I think in this situation, when I feel defensive like that, I tell myself, be curious, I'm missing something. What perspective am I missing? And I think that the difference, like when somebody says they had a traumatic birth, we shouldn't take that personally. We should see that as our patient is sharing a key component of how she experienced her birth that we were there with her for. And this is, it's terrifying. So I think we need to, like the opposite of being defensive, we need to come forward and talk with patients after these things have happened and say, like, tell them, this is trauma. You feared for your life. You feared for your child's life. Like, that's primal stuff. So not just like hope that she's going to be okay with it, but to say, like, it is real. This is scary. And lots of people need some extra resources as they're coping with it. So that's sort of like after the fact, to debrief with the family and to try to do that a couple of times, like right there, and then on postpartum rounds. And then most of these patients are coming in, they should be coming in for an incision check or a mood check if they've had a difficult time. So that's sort of like in the aftermath. When I'm seeing a patient in my office as we're working up to this, when I do this counseling, so I mentioned that I've been counseling patients that I didn't think that disparity in VBAC success was a factor that I see in my own institution. But I tell them, we know that unconscious bias and systematic racism is all around us. So we know that that's a factor at play here. And so we're working as hard as we can to try to right that. And that my goal is for my patient to feel safe and to feel heard. And that, you know, sometimes there are situations like round ligament pain where I need her to trust me that I'm providing expert reassurance that I think this is okay. I need to be willing to investigate persistent concerns, even if I feel like they're probably not a big deal. And it helps if we have the time to build that relationship. But I think just to tell patients, I know about this and it's important to me, and I want to make sure you feel heard. So if you don't feel that way, I want you to tell me. In terms of other support, the pandemic was tough to have patients go through this with, you know, one labor support person, at least was how it was for us. We did kind of like halfway through work on having doulas come back in for support. And I think their absence to me was notable. I haven't seen anything about doula support in terms of VBAC success. It's hard to find like randomized study designs for cesarean delivery, but we know that there's a lot of evidence that having trained skilled labor support it helps patients have more of the birth that they were hoping for. So I think expert labor support is a reasonable thing.
So yeah, I agree. I see that it was really tough when the doulas were sort of taken out for that period of time. I think a lot of patients really suffered from that. Mm-hmm. You rightly talk about the financial disincentive to this. Can you envision an ideal world where we can't, reimbursement-wise, where we can carve out VBAC? How would you do that?
So you get like 2.5 extra RVUs for a global fee for a VBAC for all of the work. And I don't think that even covers the counseling in the office, let alone the work of staffing that labor. But I do think it does, it sets a precedent that even if we're going to have a global fee, I think it's a precedent that some some labors, some deliveries take more work than others. So maybe we could improve that differential. There are some like critical care precedents for billing for time on the floor. And as far as I understand it, I don't think I've succeeded in getting that paid. Usually, like if I'm doing extended bedside management for a postpartum hemorrhage or something, that I think the additional billing relates to procedures. So I don't know. I'd love to hear if anybody has succeeded in getting that billed for a VBAC. But in general, the critical care support, it only applies to face-to-face time with the patient. So it doesn't cover being immediately available for something that might happen, but might not happen. I think in terms of like turning the tide of making this something that's worth people's while, you have to think about the value of a day in the office versus the value of a day sitting around labor and delivery. On the one hand, that sounds like a deal breaker. On the other hand, when I think about, you know, a global fee being like, I don't know, 70, 75 RVUs or something like that, and one TLH being 22 RVUs, it does seem like maybe when we're doing something that's this important for women's healthcare, that it's right to push for that to be expanded. So if I had a magic wand, I think that's what I'd do.
Sounds good. I am out in Washington State where we have large rural areas with no OBGYN or anesthesia readily available, and this impacts who can be offered a VBAC. Can you envision a safer way to do this in communities where the OBGYN and anesthesia are not readily available? You sort of hit on that a little bit with the British example.
Yeah. So in terms of rural areas, I think it's not safe without an obstetrician or an anesthesiologist. Right. So one option would be to find a way to get those people there. So, you know, an Uber model OB anesthesia package where you could like log on and pick up a job in rural Washington. When I think about that logistically, just the time of getting somebody there, I don't think even if you had the money that would be possible. So I think you either have to bring the patient to the care or bring the care to the patient, and bringing the care to the patient seems undoable. So I think maybe considering, you know, there are, you could do a lower threshold for induction of labor for those patients if they're willing to relocate for a planned delivery. A lot of places around the world have like a maternity waiting home model where you relocate to a safer place. In family medicine, there's a tool for assessing high risk obstetrics. So to me, that high risk means, do I need an MFM to help me decide what to do? But in the family medicine world, high risk means, do I need to tell this patient she needs to go live somewhere else for her delivery? And actually the rubric that they use was developed by a team that's in Newfoundland, because they had to identify criteria for when they needed to tell people that they had to move to the mainland at 28 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's a great solution to, but those, I think we got to do one or the other, bring the care to the patient or the patient to the care.
Yeah, no, and I think it's an interesting model to ponder. You know, I think many of us live in parts of the country where we don't think of the U.S. as being particularly rural, but those of us out on the West Coast, I mean, there are large swaths of area with no OBGYNs. You know, at all. And they can be 5-10 hours away. So we do have a question coming in from outside, so I'm going to throw that one at you and then we'll keep going. Any data when it comes to our gender diverse community for those on testosterone prior to pregnancy? Any data or lessons learned as they may experience pregnancy, labor and delivery, and the postpartum period with variation from others? And I'm not sure if there's a lot of VBAC per se data for them, but certainly anything you've got.
Wow. I don't think that there's any data on that yet. Mm-hmm. But I do think, like, going back to this, like the thought that our language matters, I think is important when dealing with a gender diverse population as well, like to normalize all different kinds of birth. And to not have it be this language of permission, of letting or allowing. I think that's important too. I'll have to look on testosterone. I can't speak to that. And if anybody in the crowd wants to pop on and share what they know, that would be welcome.
Right. Last question for you. You point out that preventing the first C-section is key to reducing risk for moms. What can we, as practicing OBGYNs, and especially those of us who train residents, help to do this? Is a 20% C-section rate achievable for hospitals that might have high-risk populations, for private practices? And what can we do to encourage a move in this direction?
That's a great question. I've been mulling that because, you know, I think a lot of places have really put a lot of effort into this to try to lower the C-section rate in recent years. And then in last year, we started with perinatal core measure 6, which is supposed to kind of give us a balance to that. So have we, in lowering our C-section rate, have we incurred some sneaky level of increased neonatal morbidity that we're just starting to get our heads around? And I don't feel like I have the answers for that yet. You know, we're tracking those things, and I don't feel like I have good comparator norms to know how I should be doing. In terms of how you would calculate what the best C-section rate would be for, especially for a high-risk person, high-risk population, I'm honestly not sure how anybody could do that, especially since, like, you know, the perinatal core measure 6 is a new one this year. So it's interesting that we set that goal before we had that measure. So I think it's something that warrants thought, but in terms of what's achievable, depending on the population, I think it's going to be very variable.
Mm-hmm.
I think like the safe prevention of the first cesarean delivery, it's like the gospel that we read out of when we're teaching our residents. So I think people should be very familiar with that. And I felt skeptical the first time I read about that so many years ago. And there's many patients that I would not have thought would have delivered vaginally who've been able to do it using that approach.
Yeah.
But you know, that was, I think that was in 2013 that came out. And so that also came along after the VBAC calculator. So I think we have to reassess all of that. I'll be really interested to see what's in the AJOG paper that comes out about the update to the calculator.
I am very interested in that too, because I do agree, you know, having worked many, many moons ago on some of the early work on VBAC through some of these big studies, I knew at that time, so one of the papers I published was looking at how race impacts who is offered trial of labor, and
right.
How did that compare to their success. And there was definitely, you know, I remember there being a concept of a biological difference that obviously is not true. So we've so changed our thinking to recognize that we were building this difference ourselves, really.
Right. Right. And even like going back to the Tatiana Ali part, I think she talked, I think somebody must have counseled her, I'm kind of imputing this, that she had an anthropoid pelvis, and she heard that as I have a pelvis like a man. Even that, the thought that there's some sort of like Caucasian superior pelvis, it's
right.
If mm-hmm. you just, I mean, it's probably in my textbooks that are on my shelf right now, but
probably,
if I just encountered that idea afresh right now in someone else's specialty, I would say that sounds like trash to me.
Right. And I think we definitely, you know, we're the data we use to make these things is such a lag. You mentioned that, you know, we're 10 years, 20, 15 years behind. We do things vastly differently than anything that's informing how we do things right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put it out to the audience. Does anyone else have questions? Because I don't want to finish up without answering questions. All right. Sorry, I'm not the best at using our webinar system, so I just want to make sure I'm not missing any. But it doesn't look like I'm seeing any. Are there any sort of ending thoughts that you want to leave us with? What is sort of the most important thing you think you've learned over your time working with patients and working with TOLACs and VBACs that you think can really help people to move forward successfully with their patients?
I think that one thought that this decision is the patient, I think is really a big deal. And when I moved to Louisville, here this was my first experience of patients who might say something like, even if you think my baby is going to die, I would rather die than have a cesarean delivery. And that was hard. So to take a step back and say, that is her right. This is a major surgery that we're talking about, and that's her right. And my job is to help her realize that. So to share the expertise that I have, to directively counsel when that's appropriate, but to recognize that this is her decision. And I think that point that I made about the chance for success, but also the value of the success, and that kind of transformed for me a lot of like the very difficult, like I'm telling the patient she's got a 30% chance for success. Why does she want to put us all through this trial of labor? to realize that it's because of the value that it had for her. And then that should be my goal as her doctor. So that kind of untied some knots and made it, you know, I think aligned my interests and the patient's interests in a way that made it more fulfilling and less stressful to have these conversations.
No, I think that's a really excellent point. I think, you know, we are invariably going to approach this differently than our patients. We think about it differently. We value it differently. A C-section is no big deal to us, but it's a huge deal to our patients. Well, I've got no more questions coming in, so I just want to say thank you. This was a wonderful talk. I'm really glad you did it. I love how you sort of addressed all those issues, and your patients are very lucky.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for coming, everybody.
All right. Thank you, everybody, and for all you watching later on video.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.